Hello everyone. Welcome to this Africa Now event, which is an event organized by the Norwegian Council for Africa every last Wednesday of the month. Today we are going to speak about Eswatini or Swaziland. And we have a very competent moderator this evening, Boris Tadiwanashe Muguti, who is an intern with us. But he is also the former leader of the biggest students' union in Zimbabwe, SINASU, and he's a human rights activist. So he has a lot in common with the activists in the panel as well. So I think give a big round of applause to Boris, and then he will introduce the rest.
Thank you very much, Hilda, for hyping me and for the wonderful introduction. Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm not going to repeat my name. Hilda has already mentioned it. I just want to thank you all for coming and welcome as well our esteemed guests from the southern part of Africa, Eswatini, Africa's only absolute monarchy as we speak. So I'm not going to delve much into that because that is what our panelists are going to do. They are going to fully unpack for us what is really transpiring on the ground in Eswatini and how we can maneuver out of that quagmire. So I'll start by inviting Mandla, who is working with... Mandla is working with Eswatini Solidarity Fund, but I also know that you have been involved in the party politics with Podemo back then. So you delve much into that, your involvement in party politics with Podemo. And I'll invite my sister Lupio, who is working with the Eswatini Lives Matter Global Solidarity Movement. Welcome, my sister. And my brother Staki, a former student leader. This is my fellow comrade. He was the Secretary General and also President. You explain to us how you managed to be Secretary General and President of the Students' Union. Thank you very much for coming. What I will do here is that... Oh, Yulia from ILF. Oh, perfect. Oh, Yulia, you eventually attended. Oh, thank you. We had so much doubts. Thank you very much for coming. We had doubts that you would show up. Thank you very much. Oh, thank you very much for coming. We are happy to have you here as well. So without wasting much time, I will start with Mandla. But before I start, I want to just give you a hint of how this is going to go. I'm going to do it in a very African manner, so everyone has to be ready. I'm not going to use a specific order. If I just feel like my brother Starkey has to come in, you have to be ready to come in. And if I feel like Yulia has to come in, then you have to come in. So I can go either way. I can start from there, from here, and from there, or anywhere. So my brother Mandla, you can start by giving us a background of the Eswatini Solidarity Fund and your involvement in that specific organization, as well as the background maybe of Podemo, if you have. I'm so sure that you have the background of the movement, how it started in 1983, why it was formed, such a background. That's what we need from you just now. I'm giving you 5 minutes.
Okay. Am I audible? I just want to make sure that people are hearing me through the... Okay, just hold it closer. Is that better? Okay. Good evening, everyone. I really want to say that... We appreciate you coming and being with us this evening. Swaziland is a remote country, if looked at from the perspective of Norway. So any interest that we can generate for what's happening in that country, the conditions of the people, is extremely useful to us. We don't take anyone's attention for granted. So the first thing we want to do is to say we appreciate you joining us this evening, and we're hoping that a few more similar-minded people will join. They're just running late. My name is Mandla Dlamini. I'm an activist from Eswatini, currently residing in South Africa. I'm in South Africa in all honest reasoning as an economic migrant. I've left the country because the prospects of survival and living a decent life are difficult to achieve in that country. My participation in this panel this evening is from the point of view of the Eswatini Solidarity Fund, which was an organization formed in 2021. 2021 is an important year in Swazi history because it's the year when the most significant form of political protest in the form of unrest was observed among the people of Swaziland. It came at the time of the COVID unrest, but what we observed was that over and above the desperation of the Swazi people, because they were forced to be locked indoors, they were forced to not earn a living on the streets, they were forced, given very serious, difficult conditions to survive. And at that point, they realized that the problem was political, and they went on a process of legitimate political protests. Unfortunately, the response by the state was a violent response, which resulted in the largest massacre that modern-day Eswatini has ever experienced, with what we believe are more than 100 people who lost their lives, hundreds more who were shot and injured and maimed, who are suffering from disabilities because of that event, and many more who have been incarcerated, families who have lost breadwinners. It was a big, big problem and a situation that caused a lot of tension and difficulty for ordinary people in Swaziland. So our organization was formed out of that, particularly to assist with everyday issues which are associated with the people who were injured and shot and killed. They needed a little bit of cash to get the problems of medical supplies, of seeing a doctor out of the way. And the Solidarity Fund did that to some extent. But because attention associated with massacres of this sort is difficult to maintain for a long time, we can see that with the Gazans, that you can check probably next week, the number will be 40,000 people who have been murdered. But ultimately, what we found out is that it's difficult to maintain a lot of attention if people are not dying, and the massacre was an intense period, but for a short time. After that, what followed was more repression and more of a structural form of violence, whereby resources that should be going to the people were now allocated to elements in the state that are used for repression. So that's a little bit of background on the solidarity. In the political front, most activism in Swaziland is motivated by a wish for a political transition into some form of people power or democracy, whereby the ordinary man can have a feeling of some semblance of self-determination. Right now, what exists in the kingdom of Swaziland, you characterize it properly, Boris, by saying that it's the last absolute monarchy. And currently, the configuration of how leaders are selected and execute their powers in that country is completely reliant on one man, the King of Swaziland. So, as an introduction, PUDEMO, that political party, is one political party amongst a growing number of political parties in that country, who are all trying to navigate the space of both being a proscribed entity and having to try and meet the needs of a population which has been fed a diet of propaganda by a state for more than 50 years. I don't want to get into answering specific questions which are linked to the formation of these political parties just yet. I know it's part of the program at some point.
Okay,
so I'll stop there.
Thank you very much for the clear articulation, both of the foundation of the Solidarity Fund and PUDEMA as well. So we'll come back to some of the issues around the Solidarity Fund, how you have been navigating through. You mentioned that you are staying in South Africa and how you managed to keep in touch with the comrades, with the ground forces in Eswatini. We'll come back to that. My sister Lupio, I will come to you now.
Yeah.
Just a brief introduction,
all right,
and also a background of the Swazi Lives Matter Global Solidarity Movement. Just a brief articulation about that.
All right. No, thank you so much for the opportunity. I think Madla has done a great job in thanking you, and I must commend Norway for keeping your democracy so alive with such spaces and such discussions. It's really a privilege to see, and perhaps something that we need to take back and see how we also try and have. So my name is Lupiwo Mgudlwa. I'm the convener of Swazi Lives Matter Global Solidarity Movement, a movement that was also born out of the uprising in 2021, when a lot of the, you know, Swazis in the diaspora could not observe only, but needed to take action in terms of what was happening at the time. And a lot of work of Swazi Lives Matter Global Solidarity Movement is really advocacy. It's advocacy on the human rights violations that are happening in Swaziland. It's advocacy on, you know, the political change that the people of Swaziland are currently asking for. If you understand the governance system in Swaziland currently, it really does not provide a people-centered governance in its essence. Swazi Lives Matter really was advocating and really looking at the international solidarity in which we can converse and lobby in giving awareness really on the issues around Swaziland, and obviously the violence that was unleashed on the people of Swaziland over peaceful demonstrations. As we currently talk, petitions are not allowed in the country, and that's a tactic, a method to try and suppress the dissent amongst the people and create a fear-based society in so far as, you know, the absolute monarchy is concerned. So that's what Swazi Lives Matter really is. And we also worked with a lot of democracy-loving people around the world. We worked a lot with people in Canada. We worked a lot with people in the United States of America. We worked a lot with people in Taiwan as well, just really trying to galvanize and understanding that in 2024, in this decade, human rights should not be a privilege, and it should not be a privilege for the people of Swaziland. And that was our stance. And as we continue to do the work that we have been doing, started it, obviously shifting it currently given the conditions and, you know, the climate within the global aspects of what is currently happening, I think that we find ourselves as humanity in general at a point where there's a lot of considerations that need to happen. So we are still trying to find the space that Swaziland must not be left behind, because the Swazi people still do deserve more dignity in terms of what it is to be a dignified human being. And we're currently trying to ensure we change that. So I hope it's short enough for you and brief you.
Thank you very much. I know you can go on and go on, but I think that's enough for now. I'll come to you, my brother Staki. Just a brief introduction and a background of the Students' Union. That is Swaziland National Union of Students, SNUS, and SWAYOKO, as well as your role that you played and that you still play in assisting young people in Eswatini in their fight for both academic freedoms and their fight for democracy through SWAYOKO.
Yeah, thank you very much, Boris. I hope I'm audible enough. As he introduced me, I'm Dlamini Thembelihle, but most comrades call me Staki. I think it's the easiest name to remember by many comrades. As I went through the journey called life, I got the privilege and honor to be borrowed those few minutes and years to lead the student movement. I led as the Secretary General, then later became the President. The discussions around power transition, we can discuss them later, Comrade Boris. But currently, I serve as the International Secretary of the Swaziland Youth Congress, as Boris said. But firstly, let me just elaborate the role of SNAS, the Swaziland National Union of Students. Basically, the role of the students' movement is uniting Swazi students in the different campuses in Swaziland, which is something that came out of, it was an organic process that came out of the lived realities and the conditions of the students in the different campuses that are there in Swaziland. The issues around issues of accommodation, issues of scholarships, and many other issues, campus issues that you would think of if you've gone through the tertiary institution. But also, SNAS realized at some point that we cannot only focus on the questions of students alone and leave out the national question, which I think part of the reasons why we are here and part of the reasons why we had that 2021 moment. We had the formation of PUDEMO in 83. We had the decree in 73. Is because at some point, somebody decided that he's wise enough to take all away all the powers of the Swazis and decided to ban political parties and trade union movement and everything. In a sense, decided to censor any voice in the country. So the students realized that, no, as the motto says of the student movement, were members of the community before we were students. In as much as we are going to discuss the issues of students in campuses, we are not going to ignore the conditions of the ordinary Swazis, young people in the different communities where we come from. The issues of unemployment. You are going to graduate from the university, you have your degree or 2 degrees, but at the end of the day, you are not going to be absorbed in the job market. Why? Because somebody somewhere decided at some point that we are going to channel all the resources that the country has towards one family. Probably they have blue blood, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But also, out of that, there was need to say we cannot only mobilize, I think out of comrades realized, cannot only mobilize young people in the tertiary institutions. There was need to have an organization that is going to mobilize young people from the different walks of life. In the communities, in the workplace, students, that is when the Swaziland Youth Congress came on. That was back 3 August 1991. But I do not want to dwell much on the processes that led to the formation of the Youth League, but the student movement played a very critical role. Just a brief history of how the student movement played a critical role in the formation of SWAYOKO. It goes back to the Black Wednesday in the main university, 14 November 1990, where the king and the state basically decided to unleash armed forces into the university. And at that time, students were protesting. And amongst the grievances that were there, interestingly so, was that there was a lecturer who was expelled from the university, a sociology lecturer was expelled from the university because, amongst other things, he was suspected to be involved in the underground movement, PUDEMO underground movement. And they had he was arrested with 10 others and charged with treason in 1990. So after that, there was that conference that we had in 1991 that led to the formation of SWAYOKO to this far.
Thank you very much, my brother. We'll come back again to, you gave us a background and a history of the Students' Union and the Youth Wing as well, SWAYOKO. So I'll come back to you for how specifically of what you have done so far, how you have been doing it and the challenges that you are facing currently. So without wasting much time, I'll come to you, Yulia. I know you have been collaborating with these guys in Eswatini, so maybe you can just tell us for now how you have been cooperating with them and how you started working with them. Because as for me, I think I started knowing about the struggle for democracy in Eswatini, I think around 2020, when I met another comrade from the Students' Union. And I actually met him through a Zoom meeting, and he was articulating the situation on the ground. And I said, no, this is happening in Eswatini. I thought Zimbabwe is worse, but I think we're actually better. There is a country that actually needs our solidarity and help there. So maybe you can also tell us how you came to know from an Eastern Europe country that down there in the southern part of Africa, there is a struggle that needs our support, that needs our hand to chip in and support their fight.
Yes, thank you so much for the question, and thank you also so much for letting me attend this great panel discussion. And I'm very honored to sit here with such good and strong people that also knows a lot more about Eswatini or Swaziland than I do. But I also have been working a lot with Swaziland, and I work in AOF, where I am the international leader, and for the three last years, I have been very lucky to also lead the project with AOF, LO, and Svayoko. So it is a very, very important project for us, which we have been doing, I believe, since 2010. So it's for a very, very long time, and it's a very, very important project for us. And it's a very great question about how we even started to do this. But it's a matter of fact that in AOF and for also LO, it's very important that our solidarity knows no borders. So we see the whole world. We don't just see Norway, or we just don't see Europe. We see the whole world. And what is happening in Swaziland is really an issue that is that's not happening any other places, because it is, as you said, it's the last absolutely monarchy in the world, and it has been a very meaningful project for us to be a part of and to lead. And we also have learned so much from our comrades in Svayoko. So it's been very good for us to also do it. But also, it's been very hard. I went to South Africa 2 years ago in 2022 to where we were with the borders to South Africa. So we should meet up with the borders. And also 12 of our comrades from Swayoko were taken to prison because they were not allowed to meet us. And that also tells us the very truth about the situations that really happen in Swaziland, and also gave us a really, really wake-up call, but also shows us how important this project is. And that's why we still do it every time. It's important from the Labour Youth Movement. It's important for LO, and I'm really grateful that we do this together and that we fight for democracy and for freedom together.
Thank you very much, Julia, and thank you for the magnanimity that you have shown as AUF collaborating with our brothers in Eswatini, because they really need our support. I come from Zimbabwe. We are also in a crisis. We need help. But we actually understand that the situation in Eswatini is beyond ours, and these brothers also need our arm. And thank you very much for remembering them and collaborating with them. And we hope that you are going to work on more projects and continue collaborating with them and helping them until we achieve democracy in Eswatini. I'll come back to you again, my brother Mantla. You gave us a background of the organization that you lead, Eswatini Solidarity Fund, as well as PUDEMO. But right now, I want to come back to you so that you give us sort of a brief account of how we ended up here with the banning of political parties, a situation in which leaders of the opposition movement have to flee outside the country. Most of them are staying in Johannesburg and some in Pretoria, and a lot of comrades are in exile right now. How did we end up here? Just a brief account in 5 minutes. I just want you to tell us what really transpired and how it happened for us to get into this situation where we ended up with King Mswati as the absolute leader of the country and the sole decision maker in the country.
Okay. Thanks, Boris. And I just have one small request. We traveled all the way from Eswatini. We are here primarily to, you know, have a discussion with people in Norway and to have. So one of the small requests that we have is that I would actually love to hear at some point the audience. We attended an event yesterday, but we couldn't really participate with the panel audience. So I will cede some of my time in responding to your questions in order to open up more space at the end. I believe that this room is small enough for everyone to actually, you know, raise if they've got any ideas. And we're really curious to also hear from you what you have heard in the presentation. It helps us when we go back and we talk to people back home about, because while you are getting a feeling from us, they also want to get through us a feeling of how you have received the information that we have disseminated here. But going back to the question, how is it that Eswatini is the last absolute monarchy? Monarchies exist in Southern Africa. They exist in South Africa. They exist in Botswana. There are monarchies all over the African continent, but none of them are in power in the same way that the monarchy in Swaziland is in power. The monarchy in Swaziland currently is in charge of all arms of government, the executive, the judiciary, and the legislature. They have full control of what happens there, even though if you read the constitution and whatever literature that the state may give to people, it may seem as if there are some voting rights accorded to the people. But in practice and in reality, it's an absolute monarchy. There's a long history towards it. We can choose various dates in history. The first date in history that perhaps I would suggest would be at the advent of the formation of South Africa. Swaziland is unique in one way. There are more ethnic Swazis in South Africa than there are in Swaziland itself. How come their country was carved up into a little 17,000 square meter area on the eastern side of South Africa? Well, colonialism had a big part to play with that. Competing interests among colonial powers required the British to set up a protectorate in Swaziland. That's one theory around the formation of Swaziland, which they were intending to keep in order to neutralize South African Boer republics from formulating an access to the Indian Ocean. But be that as it may, Swaziland operated as a colony. The British call it a protectorate, but that's a fancy word for just being that we are your colony. In 1920, they appointed amongst the traditional leaders of Swaziland. The Swazis are very homogeneous people. We are all one way or another related simply because of our population. We have one language. Many of us can trace our origins towards specific groupings in the country. So there is cultural harmony among Swazis. But at the time when the British took over, they wanted only to work with one set of leaders, and they happened to pick on one particularly large tribe, and they anointed that tribe leader the paramount chief, and that was King Sobhuza, or the kingship under the Dlamini dynasty. If you move forward into the advent of independence, when the states in Africa were all, you know, vying for independence and being able to self-determine. Swaziland was put under the grouping of the British High Commission territories, which was Lesotho, Botswana, and Swaziland. All of these were administered under the same British administrative office. The interesting thing is that while both Botswana and Lesotho obtained independence in 1966, Swaziland had a delay in its independence. It was only afforded independence in the year 1968. The reason why was that there was a lot of contestation about the form and nature of the type of system that would follow colonialism. The Swaziland, being what it was, had a very strong traditional authority in the form of the king or the Ingwenyam. And they were not happy with the democratic constitution, or what we refer to as the Westminster constitution that was given to countries which were earning their independence in those times. So it was delayed. Eventually, with all the groups which were jostling to have a voice in the formation of this new governance system, they were able to get to a point of independence. And it was a nascent democracy. It had a lot of the rights that a modern democracy would accord to its citizens. There was an election, and the party which the king was head of, he had to set up a party. It was not a party in any real sense. It was a party on paper representing traditional interests. And they won all the seats. They were a one-party state, but obtained through a democratic process. 5 years later, in the interim, there've always been small political parties or people who are progressive within the society. While they didn't achieve any success in 1968, they did achieve something in 1973. Three of the 24 seats that would go into the House of Assembly or the Parliament, the House of Assembly, were won by an emerging political Pan-African party called the Ngwane National Liberatory Congress. And they won three seats, and that sent shockwaves through the traditional leadership and authority of the king. The monarchy didn't understand how it could share power with people who they haven't appointed. And 1 year later, as a result of all these scares, and in the midst of a condition in Africa that was allowing the king to do that, in 1973, if you were to freeze frame in the movie of life, there was a lot of strife in Africa. Mozambique was in chaos. South Africa itself was in difficulties. There was a Rhodesian war in your country. So Africa was known as a place of war at that time. So relying or taking the opportunity to say that, look, this democracy business is not working for Africans. The king took over all state power through a coup d'etat, but not a coup d'etat where guns tanks were driven to your police headquarters or the parliament. It was a coup d'etat in words, where he abrogated all rights. He stopped the functioning of the constitution, the Westminster Constitution, and said, all powers are with me. Immediately banned all political party activities. And it's a moment in history that all Swazis have to know if they are serious about politics, because it's the day that our lives actually took the wrong trajectory. So we refer to that day of 12 April 1973 as the 1973 decree. This is all happening in a short period. 1968 to 1973 is less than 5 years of a new democracy trying to survive, and someone snatches the power that was given to the people away from them. A short while later, the monarch at the time, King Sobhuza, passes away, and the country is still officially in a state of emergency. All powers are in one person's hands. Rule is by decree of the monarch. So what he says will happen. The king passes away, and there's, as you have with monarchies, contestation for who's going to take over the power. Eventually, the new king is installed in 1986. But in the interim, newer, more focused, I would say, political entities such as Putemo are formed. Staki, I'm sure, will have given a little bit of detail in his earlier presentation about the formation of Swayoko. Putemo preceded Swayoko's formation in 1983, simply because of the crises that were emerging during that uncertain period between the installation of King Mswati and the death of his father. So you have a new king who has now been installed onto a throne, and he has inherited absolute power from the coup d'etat that his father effected in 1973. What is the expectation of this, of the people of Swaziland? Are they expecting him to return back the constitutional era that existed before? Because Swaziland was operating without a constitution at that time. In fact, what the king does, because he's a young man, he's 18 years old at the time, doesn't do much. The country continues as it was. The formation of these political parties does cause a thorn in his side. So he's forced at some point through international pressure, because states around the world don't look at a country and say, are you a country? Where's your constitution? That country didn't have that. So they were forced to go through a process of obtaining a constitution in one way or another. Ultimately, the constitution was effected in 2005, but the process towards the development of that constitution was not inclusive. In fact, it was just a window dressing type of exercise, which we can go through later. And I'm now getting cautious about the time. But that's how we end up with an absolute monarchy in Swaziland.
Oh, thank you very much. I think that's enough to shed light on how we ended up here. You did that very well. And I think, my brother Staki, some of the issues that I wanted you to highlight have already been highlighted by my good brother Mandla. So what I want you to do now is to just tell us about the challenges that you are facing as young people in Eswatini, as well, not just as Swayoko, but also the Students' Union, SNAS. You have been the Secretary General there, and at one point you were also president. So just the challenges that the Students' Union is facing, and the challenges that our young people, that young people are facing in Eswatini.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity. You know, it's very, very difficult to explain all the problems that young people are facing in Swaziland in 5 minutes, but I will try and cover some of these things. But I think, taking from what Comrade Mandla has just elaborated on, you will realize that in the history of the country, as it happens, there has been an effort, amongst other things, to make sure that there is no opposing voice. So what do you do when you do not want opposition in your country? You open the jails. So one of the problems that young people are facing, as we are sitting here having this conversation here, is that Swaziland is full of young people in the Mswati's prisons. Some of them have not been charged, but because of the 2021 unrest, they are behind bars and they do not know when they're going to go to court and have probably a semblance of justice. So amongst other things, I want to highlight that young people are in prisons. Some of them have short visits of torture here and there, so that they can implicate people to say, we were given information and instruction by so and so to do what 1, 2, and 3. So many, some of them that have appeared before court that have been officially charged, the charge is sedition and under the Suppression of Terrorism Act. I'm not talking about people who are 40, 30. I'm talking about, amongst other things, young people who are below the age of 18. I'm talking about people who are 19, 20, who are behind Mswati's prisons. Those who are outside of the prison walls, as I would to put it, into the larger prison that is called Swaziland. They'll do very well in school, get good grades. Time comes for them to go to the university. I mean, we understand Swaziland has a poverty rate of 69%. So 69% of the population lives with below $2 a day. So now they have to go to tertiary institutions. They cannot afford the exorbitant charges and prices that are put in institutions of higher learning. So we rely on government for scholarships, right? But unfortunately, those scholarships are limited because Swaziland does not have enough money. But we do have enough money to build more than 15 palaces. We do have enough money to buy the latest Rolls Royces for 20 wives or 15 wives. We do have enough money to build ICC, which is what the conference building that they are building there, which was said to be going to cost around 500 million. I think now the cost are around 7 billion in our currency, which is rands or emalangen. So those are some of the things. You have young people who cannot even access basic contraceptives in the different health facilities in the country. You have young people who, when they go to the hospitals or the clinics, when they need basic paracetamol, they cannot get access to that because government cannot afford. You have young people who go to schools, and those schools do not have even enough teachers to give lessons. So that is the situation that young people currently face. Now you find ways, you finish your tertiary, I graduated 2017, for example, I did my basic nursing. I have a degree in nursing. Most of the people that I graduated with in that profession that you think is a very big need in society are still without jobs. Some are trying to go for second degrees. Some have resorted into other things. That is the situation. You have young people who are now have become preys to the older people. I mean, when you look at the statistic of HIV in the country now, you realize that a lot of young girls between the age of 16 and 24 have high rate of HIV compared to their age mates. So, and when you understand how the virus gets to be spread, you realize that, no, the HIV is not coming from their peers. It comes from intergenerational sex. And this intergenerational sex comes because there is an environment that necessitates that for you to have sex, there must be transactions that are taking place. And your peers are not going to afford. So now the next thing is, the older people who are working are the ones who are coming for the young girls. So that is the situation of young people in the country. And the last one, which I think is very critical to a certain solidarity fund going forward, is that we have young people who are fleeing the country into exile. As they flee the country into exile, the nearest country they can get to is South Africa and Mozambique. South Africa has passed a very, very dangerous, and I think it's a very unprogressive problem on the question of migration. So they're going into South Africa, and South Africa has taken a position not to allow or recognize refugees. So now these young people are going into South Africa, because most of them go to South Africa, not knowing what is going to happen the following day.
Oh, thank you very much. You touched on a lot of issues, unemployment, the harassment of young activists, HIV, AIDS, and the abject poverty that is in the country. We'll come back to some of the issues that you raised there, I think, in the next 10 minutes. My sister Lupio, just I'm giving you 3 minutes. I'm very sorry, because we want to budget enough time for interaction with the audience, as my brother highlighted earlier. So I just want you to touch on the challenges that women activists are facing in this current situation, and just how it feels to be a woman in the struggle for democracy in Eswatini.
Sure. It's very difficult to even try and give you a proper answer at the extent and the level of challenges that are there for women activists. I mean, if you understand the conditions of oppression within the country and also understand that women in general, you know, particularly in a society which is very cultural, in a society that is very cultural as well, women are the most oppressed, both in social terms, both politically, you know, and also economically generally. So there's a lot of issues around women and a lot of challenges. But I think one of the main challenges is the, you know, the recognition or the lack of empowerment of women themselves to understand the role that they need to play in society, because they deal with a lot of challenges on a daily basis. So it's quite difficult to get into the political space in Swaziland, because we see evidently, you know, what happens to activists. We also have, you know, I think Astaki touches on quite profoundly the issues around young people and young women in particular, in terms of the economic conditions that they face. So there really is no space currently for the development of young women or women in general, for them to be able to play a very pivotal role in the political space, which is a huge challenge, because we don't necessarily have an adequate number or adequate women playing a role that they should be playing, which I've seen here in Norway is quite a big thing. I mean, I'm sitting to one young woman here. just maybe to try and cut short as well. You know, so there are various issues around women activists in Swaziland. You can just only imagine, you know, with the regime and the current state of government. I mean, the working conditions as well for women in Swaziland, they're critical for us to start talking about the role of, you know, trade unions and how they ensure there's a particular focus on women, and also ensuring that, you know, women are capacitated in Swaziland for them to be able to take up issues in the workplace is quite very important, and it's a challenge as well. I said I'll give you 1 minute. I hope it is.
Okay, thank you very much, and I'm sorry for giving you a few minutes, but we are running out of time, and as my brother Mandla mentioned, we have a lot of interesting people here, former activists, and some people are working with different organizations in Norway who can have insight into the topic as well. So it's good to spare some time so that we also get some ideas from them. And Yulia, I just want you to add a little bit on this, and also maybe highlight some of the challenges that you have faced as you collaborated with these guys. Not that the problem that these guys have, but maybe the challenges that you have faced, and some of the efforts that you are making to make sure that there is increased support. Because if we look into Eswatini, it seems like the world doesn't know about what is happening in Eswatini. And what are you doing to make sure that you also amplify the issue of the fight for democracy in Eswatini, and to make sure that more partners, even in Norway, mm-hmm. also come on board and collaborate with these great comrades in Eswatini?
Thank you so much for a good question. And I also just want to follow up on what you said about women's rights in Eswatini, because that is one of the topics we work mostly on in AOF, and we focus a lot on in the collaboration. And when I visited Svajoko in the Congress in 2022, I met a woman called Bongi, and she told me about living as a woman in Eswatini, and she told me some dramatic histories about how she needed to prostitute herself to even have a life, and she told me that she didn't have the opportunity to even buy her own house, and if, for example, she got a son, the son would be the owner of the house and not her, because she was a woman, and that women need to kneel for men, and that was a very, very strong perspective for us, and also something we really, really got engaged in and wanted to learn more about. And I felt really a strong connection with all the women in Svajoko, and that has also been a very big part of our collaboration. And we really, really are together in the fight for democracy, but also for equal rights between all genders. A good question you asked also is how the international society should get engaged in what's happening in Swaziland, because it's a matter of fact that most people in the world doesn't know about Swaziland. They don't know what's happening. And therefore, we have such a big, we need to help to spread the news. So we need to talk about it in the media, and that has both AOF and ALO done together. And our prime minister, we're actually out criticizing the king in media. And I don't know if it was, it wasn't a big thing in Norway, but I know that the king in Swaziland wasn't, it got a big thing in Swaziland actually, because it's not typical that the leaders in other countries actually, and especially in Europe, do criticize and get engaged in what's happening in Swaziland. So I thought it was a really good thing. But we really do have still a long way to go with telling the stories, telling about what's happening, and really get people to understand what you guys are fighting against. But I really hope that we can make a change together.
Okay, thank you very much, Julia. But just to add on that, what do you think the government of Norway can do? What role can the government of Norway play to at least assist these comrades in their strive for democracy?
I think that the Norwegian government has a very important role to make a clear appointment that we to say to the king that we can't accept what's happening, because it's the absolutely it's the last absolute monarchy in the world, and we're not accepting other things that are happening in the world, so that we can do that with this issue. And I believe that we also should do other things, for example, as building strong trade unions, and to build democracy, and to really do what's important to actually build a stronger Swaziland.
Okay, thank you very much. My brother Mandla, one of the, maybe second from last questions for you, what can be the role of SADC, and maybe particularly South Africa? Lupio talked about South Africa, and also my brother Staki Tembelihle also mentioned about the regulations that have been passed by South Africa. They can't take refugees from Eswatini, if I heard it well there. And what role can South Africa and the rest of SADC play in making sure that we achieve democracy in Eswatini.
Okay. Earlier I had indicated that there are more Swazis in South Africa, ethnic Swazis, than there are in Swaziland. 2 million in Mpumalanga, which is a neighboring province to Swaziland, and 1.4, just under 1.4 million Swazis in Swaziland. South Africa is, in terms of culture, in terms of relatability, in terms of relatability to the state of Swaziland, there are arguments that say that state is not a viable state as it is, even if it were to be democratic. However, I'm trying to get to the point whereby I give you an understanding of how important South Africa is as a neighboring country and as a big brother to that smaller country. There are those cultural and human ties. There's also an economic condition, which is much more serious than the state of Swaziland wants to admit. Every country has a way of trading with the rest of the world. Swaziland relies completely on South Africa for its survival. There are financial agreements with the South African state that keeps Swaziland afloat. One of them is the Southern African Customs Union, which is a normal customs union. However, it's configured in such a way that it distributes more money to the smaller states. However, the origin of that money actually comes from South Africa. And then there's the common monetary area. I'm glad people from Zimbabwe, who are mainly now financial experts, understands how currencies fluctuate. The reason why we don't have the same type of hyperinflation, yet we've got governments which are on the same levels of recklessness, is because we have a common monetary area agreement with South Africa. Our rand, or Lilangeni, is pegged one-to-one with the South African rand. So I'm trying to paint a picture that says to you, if your economy relies on another country, that other country has a lot of power over you. So that's one way that we've been signaling. And it's interesting, just recently, the only thing that has really brought that to the fore is the fact that state institutions in Swaziland have been found to be allowing rogue elements for what they call hot money or money laundering. An international consortium of journalists have now released a whole tranche of leaks, about 890,000 documents or so, of coming from the financial regulator in Swaziland, indicating that there are serious concerns about how this country manages its finances and the type of characters which are actually working in the countries, who are making partnerships with the state. So the only reason why Swaziland exists is because South Africa allows it to exist in this configuration. They have a lot of power. However, there are a lot of internal contestations in that country. They are trying to resolve their internal issues before complicating their lives in long-standing agreements. The first thing that people say when they talk about SACU is that it's the oldest customs union on earth. There is no customs union which is older than the Southern African Customs Union, established in 1903. But that's the one way they survive. So South Africa has a role to play. Never mind the fact that South Africa is a constitutional democracy, which is attempting and in some ways succeeding to give people the right to elect their government. SADC, your next question. The Southern African Development Community. The institution has proven to be a fairly weak institution for moderating the excesses of states or leaders in various African countries. We know that from the example of Zimbabwe. And recently we saw that in the intervention that they were signaling they would make in Swaziland. One of the outcomes of the June, July 2021 unrest was that SADC was forced to actually deal with this in their security cluster. And the security cluster sent their leader at the time, who was the president of South Africa, the chairperson of the Security Commission, to Swaziland, and they came out with a deal that said Swaziland should go to a national dialogue in which all the parties which have grievances should be given a fair hearing. And that was the last time we really heard a strong statement from SADC. 2 years down the line, there has not been any dialogue, and they have not followed up on this. In fact, they have started cozying up with King Mswati again. He's reintegrating himself into the same leadership networks that were existing before the unrest. So, in short, the two elements, South Africa and Swaziland, South Africa and the SADC, that's how they have an influence on the general politics in the country.
Thank you. SADC is a fairly weak institution. I got that. I picked that. My sister Lupio, maybe just to sum up, what can be done? I mentioned earlier on that it seems like the world is not aware of what is happening in Eswatini. Some do not even know that there's a country called Eswatini. So what do you think needs to be done in order to amplify the struggle and to alert the international community about what is transpiring in Eswatini and the role of the media as well?
Yeah, no, thank you for that question. I think, you know, part of the reason why we are in Norway is exactly that. To ensure that, you know, we play our part in gaining efforts of advocacy, of awareness, and also lobbying, towards the issues of Swaziland. So I do think that a lot can be done in the various different elements that would culminate into, you know, bringing more of the treasury that is happening in Eswatini. One of the things that we have taken a keen interest in is ensuring that we ourselves, are coordinated in the manner in which we want to continue to ensure that the Swazi issue is still amongst the community, especially in the international community. And I think that's the one way. I think that, my colleagues mentioned earlier on that there was, the uprising was a period in which a lot of us had to take action, an urgent action because of the violence that was happening. So I do think that there's an opportunity, for us to collaborate in partnerships where we are able to raise the issues of Swaziland, but not necessarily in isolation as well. I think there needs to be a shift, and I think it's happening. I think that the old ways of the world and how, the global aspects of politics and, humanity and how we relate to each other are seeking that we look at things differently and we do things differently. So I do think that what can be done immediately, I think there's diplomatic, engagements that can be done, to ensure that the issue of Swaziland is on the table. I think that, with the solidarity work that Norway is doing quite fundamentally in other areas and other countries as well, there's really opportunities for us to be able to collaborate with such. I mean, we have a serious issue as well in terms of the exposure. I think the exposure is limited. So if we can look at ways in which we can use the networks of Norway and Norway's partners, whether it's around the Palestine issues, so that it does not become an isolated issue, we we should be able to do things like that to ensure we amplify the voice of Swaziland. But I think that, you know, also there needs to be specific focus in how we deal with Swaziland. I think the real issue of it being such a small country sometimes comes up, and that then, you know, does not necessarily receive a lot of engagement, but we need to work together. I think that it's part of the reason why we're here, and we need to do more of that, and also use the channels and the partnerships. And I mean, you know, the Norwegian Council for Africa has done a great job for us in enabling us to bring the awareness, and also, you know, talk to different people on how we can do the work that needs to be done on the issue of Swaziland, so that Swaziland does not get left behind.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My brother, Staki Tembelihle, I know you like both of the names, but I prefer Staki. As young people in Eswatini, you are the vanguards of democracy. This is your country. You are the future of Eswatini. Given the background, given the challenges, given all what you have mentioned that is happening in Eswatini, all the powers lie in the hands of the king. Muswati is buying Rolls Royces for his wives, living a luxurious lifestyle, and young people do not have access to opportunities. Young people are behind bars. Most of them will try to speak out and stand against autocracy in the country. Is there hope for Eswatini? Do we have hope that there will be a democratic Eswatini in our lifetime?
That's quite a very, very interesting question. Let me try to answer it in this way. I think by the time when the decree was passed in Swaziland by Sobhuza, 1973. It's the same year when the UN decided to call classify apartheid as a crime against humanity. And I think in that year, a lot of young comrades from South Africa, where some of them were in Swaziland, some of them were in prison. And I'm sure if that question came to them at that time, they were going to give you this response. No, the question is should not be whether is it going to happen or not. But I think the question should be, if it happens, how long is it going to take? Because, I mean, Swaziland is going to be democratic. All the signs are there that the regime in Swaziland is putting fuel into a fire to make sure that the democratization process takes place very fast. I mean, you cannot be living the life that Mswati and his kids are living in that kind of condition and expect that young people are going to watch and say, there is nothing that we can do. The danger with what Mswati is doing and the regime in Swaziland is doing is that it might happen that when the change process takes place, there might be no space for that family in the new democratic Swaziland. And it's going to be a very sad thing for people who like monarchs. I personally do not like monarchs. I think their time came and their time in this earth, I think it has passed. So, I mean, they do nothing but sit because they have blue blood. They're parasitic, most of them, by their nature. So Swaziland is going to be democratic in as much as they enjoy a lot of support from a lot of these diplomatic corps. Because I think Comrade Mandla was mentioning the issue of the leaks by the what is currently obtaining in Swaziland. And part of those things, you get to realize the hands of, amongst other things, the state of Israel. The companies in Israel who have invested a lot of energy, time to help the Swazi state stay in power. They have this technology now that is spying on everybody, that they are able to even clone your phone and even hear on your conversations. You might be thinking you're conversating, Yulia, with your comrades in Swaziland, but that conversation might end up in the wrong hands because some people somewhere have decided to say, we are going to assist these people. In 2021, these are the very same people that decided that for a period of 3 weeks when the army was killing people, decided to shut down the internet. The whole country, there was no internet mode of communication in the 21st century. So, and we know very well that the state on its own does not have that capacity. It has this support from these other states that enables the state. And the last question that I think we need to ask ourselves about, fortunately you come from Zimbabwe, is how is it that in Swaziland there is a decree that has taken more than 50 years, but we've never heard about Swaziland being sanctioned? Zimbabwe, 20 years after democracy, I think the sanction started in 2003. There's never been that kind of discussion in the Western world and everywhere else about Swaziland. Are we too less of human beings that human rights, when they're being violated in Swaziland, we turn a blind eye? Thanks, Kamri.
So touching. Are we too less of human beings to deserve the support that others deserve in the global arena? We have seen a lot of countries that have been put under sanctions by the EU, by America, because of human rights abuses, particularly in my country, Zimbabwe. So because of time, I'm going to give each of you 1 minute.
I think the audience wants to engage now.
Okay, I just wanted to give you each of you 1 minute, and then we go to the audience. But
let's have an engagement.
Okay, it's fine. So my brother Mandla, I know you have a lot to say, but in 1 minute, I just want you to give the parting shots, your last words, before we end the discussion.
Oh, okay. I mean, I'm sorry, Boris. If I'm going to respond to anything that the audience...
You will respond when the discussion starts in the next 3 minutes.
Okay, I can do mine and cede more time to more engagement. Mm. If there's anything that we would like to leave here having impressed upon whoever that we've engaged in, is that we know that that country will, at some point, return the dignity of the majority of the people. And whether that is through the winning of a democratic dispensation in whatever method, whether it's through revolution or whether it's through a negotiated settlement, we know that it will happen. The question of solidarity is the game of giving solidarity is essentially how quickly are you going to get there. The more we go around expressing the needs of that country, bringing it to the attention of people who are able to assist, the quicker they can make up their mind about whether they think it's a worthy thing for them to get involved in. So, in short, the people of Swaziland are in desperate need of solidarity. It's clear that the posture that the state has taken is that they are not willing to negotiate with the needs of the people. They need to be forced to come to the table. And it's only through acts of solidarity that we are able to reach the type of mass mobilization that will make and force the existing regime in Swaziland to come to the table to talk to people who want to get their lives going better than what is in existence at the moment. So that's 1 minute or less. I'm looking forward to engagements on anything. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, my brother. I want to set aside enough time for the discussion. So I'll end with Yulia, maybe.
We can just go to the questions, it's fine.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can go to the questions, but I wanted you to give sort of a helicopter approach because these comrades sound so optimistic. Most all of them are agreeing that there is going to be democracy in Eswatini. So maybe they are being driven by emotions and their feelings and their hope for things to get better in Eswatini. So as people who are indirectly involved in this fight for democracy in Eswatini, maybe you can give us a more objective view of if there is going to be democracy in Eswatini anytime soon, as these comrades are saying.
Yes, I believe at some time, and I hope, and we will, of course, fight together every day, that there will be freedom and democracy in Eswatini. However, we can't say that the world and Europe and other international institutions needs to have a wake-up call for what's happening. Because right now, Swaziland or Eswatini isn't really even a topic. We're not even discussing it. We're not speaking about the solutions. We're not saying that what we should do. We're not saying that what we should do with the king, or that we should do this and that. So we're not doing and discussing what we really should discuss. So I believe that Swaziland will be free, but it would also take some time. And we have a very, very big, we need to really do something to make the world wake up. And I'm really, really happy that you're here and that you're speaking about it in Norway and that we can talk about it and share knowledge. But it's a big, big issue and topic for us.
Thank you very much. May you give a round of applause for our panelists for doing a great job. So right now, I will not say I'm opening room for questions. We are just going to have a discussion with you guys. Those who want to raise issues that they feel like they need to be raised in this panel, you are free to do so. Those who have questions for the panelists, you are also free to ask questions. They'll be here to respond to all your questions. I'll start with you.
So thank you. I work in the Youth LO. So I have a question, because we had an event this morning about South Africa, because it's 30 years since the apartheid regime ended. And what we can see in South Africa, you asked in the end of the panel discussion, is that what will happen when it becomes a democracy, or will it ever become a democracy? And we saw that in South Africa, due to international pressure, we ended up with democracy being included. And ANC has won every election since, and with absolute numbers in the parliament. But we see that it is still a lot of issues, on equality, youth unemployment, a lot of things that aren't really doing good for the country. And people say that South Africans has almost voted for the empty seat of Nelson Mandela, and have voted for ANC, and they are losing votes. But do you have a plan for after, for what you are going to do with the democratic society, and how you are going to build a strong democracy and take some challenges up front? Thank you.
Yeah. To take
I think I'll try and attempt where I leave off. I think Comrade Mandla will come in. Well, I think the premise of our struggle in Swaziland does not only end at a democratic dispensation where we saw in South Africa, where people have the right to vote for a political party or also an individual. We believe that is just a means towards an end. And what is the end that we're talking about, amongst other things? It's about better housing, better living conditions for the people of Swaziland, access to land, economic opportunities for a lot of young Swazis. Building a state that is going to be capable of taking care of the needs of the ordinary Swazis. And we know very well, which I think part of the reasons why we are having these kind of conversations with our friends, partners, and everybody else, is that we know very well that process does not need to take place after democracy has been achieved in Swaziland. It's a process that we need to inculcate even as we move with the democratic processes. And we know very well, amongst other things, that what is going to assist that thing to be achieved is building strong institutions that are going to be the backbone of the democracy that we want. These are the strong institutions that are going to say when the democracy is achieved. But comrades, we did not fight. Our comrades did not die so that you can drive a Rolls Royce. We fought so that the ordinary Swazis can live a better life and can live with dignity. So those are some of the things that I think at the core of our democratization process is. We're not only fighting just to have political parties in Swaziland. Of course, we need that. But at the center of it is moving the Swazi from one social gradient to the next social gradient. I think that's what drives some of us and most of us in the democratization process.
Yeah. I think to add on to what Comrade Starkey has indicated, it's one of the more interesting things about coming from Southern Africa is you get to see some of the extreme statistics which are reported in the media in real life. When someone says the most unequal country on earth is South Africa, you get to see how a wealthy person lives right next to you and how a person who's in abject poverty lives in large quantities. What that does to you is essentially what it does to me, actually, is that it makes me think exactly about the question that was asked right now. How do you get to a point whereby whatever system or government that's in place can come to avoid these disasters in human outcomes? And to me, above the strengthening of institutions, is we have to find ways of popularizing people with the right values to take over institutions and positions of power. What we have observed, especially in the mass democratic movement, is that it's easy for what is currently popular to entrench itself in politics. And often that's not what's best for everyone in the society. We have new political parties which have imbalances, which don't want to separate which don't want to have, for instance, fundamental separations between church and state. They want the religion to have an input on how governance is conducted in the country, which is a known danger to any society. So development of people with an emphasis on ensuring that the values which are able to sustain democracies are entrenched in those people that we are developing is extremely important. So strong institutions mean strong people who have been developed and have accepted the values that make democracy successful. So that's what we hope to achieve if we are to take a vision of a post-monarchy in Swaziland.
Maybe just too quickly, I don't want to take too much of your time to the colleagues. I think just to simply answer the question, I think the institutions that are going to be part of the democracy are the institutions that we're here representing. And already in the way in which we run these institutions, we do have a plan. We do have a plan about the configuration of the economy in Swaziland and how it can assist, the current situation in Swaziland. So I think the question around, obviously adding more into what my colleagues are saying, of whether the plan is there, vis-a-vis on what you see in South Africa where democracy came, and yet, you know, you have these weakened institutions insofar as its democracy is playing. I think we do have a particular plan. It's just that at this moment we're not able to obviously get deeper into it because there are these challenges. But in terms of having a particular plan, I do think that as we sit here as comrades, as we sit here as community workers, there's a particular plan that we have in mind, and we're sure that as we try and parallel the process of gaining democracy, we also try and parallel a process that's going to be a sustainable democracy within the future, and perhaps echo around the African continent as well. I think there's an opportunity to model Swaziland quite very well in terms of what it is that we can achieve as a people, insofar as what we're calling for, sustainable for generations to come.
Thank you very much.
Hello. I have three questions, but I have one observation. I think we still have more than one absolute monarchy in the world. Maybe you meant Africa. Okay, because Vatican City here is still, My first question is, do you think democracy is a one-size-fits-all compared to a monarchy in Africa? Because personally, I do not believe in democracy for African people. We could debate from tonight till tomorrow, but we are not here to do that. That's my first question. This is not to say the king should remain, though, just so you know. And the second question is this. If the king decide to change, if he says today that let's turn to democracy, and it becomes one of the candidates, what is the probability that it would not win the election? And what is the probability that it would not stay in power for the next 20 years, just like in Cameroon or even in Zimbabwe? That's the second question, which means, are the electorate, are they actually, informed? Because for democracy to work, we need educated electorate, which means the citizens have to have some sort of, some high level of education. And the third question, apart from power sharing, what do the Eswatini people, what are they deprived of now that you think when you're in democracy you will get it? And the reason why I'm saying that is because I heard you talking about we want access to housing and blah, blah, blah. Democracy do not give that based on what we've seen in Africa. And, for example, even South Africa, you said the unemployment rate, poverty rate in Eswatini is currently 69%. In South Africa, among the black people, it's 64%. So I do not see difference, the differences. So those are my questions. I could probably summarize them if you want.
All right, thank you very much. I think one of the things that drove me to come here was you highlighted on it in your last statement that are we less of a human beings that the world does not talk about the issues that are happening in Eswatini. I was in South Africa in 2021 when the unrest happened. And I think about 50 people were killed in a very short space of time. A fortnight later, there was unrest in South Africa, I think in July, and everything that was being talked about Swaziland died. It was now about South Africa. A year before that, on the 14th of January in Zimbabwe, there was a demonstration, a handful of people, I'm not comparing deaths, but a handful of people were killed. Zimbabwe was attacked from all angles. You have the British, you have the Americans. At times, if you even pay attention to the British Parliament, you would think it's a Zimbabwean Parliament. And I have not heard anywhere where Eswatini is talked about. And I think one of the solutions that we need to start to think about, SADC will not help us. SADC, I don't even think SADC is a toothless bulldog. It's not even a dog. Mm. SADC will not help us. It's a group of the so-called revolutionary parties that protect each other. The opposition, the young people in Zimbabwe, the opposition in South Africa, the opposition in Eswatini, I think we need to build ties. That's the best solidarity we can have, to build ties as the opposition so that the change in Southern Africa in particular, most of it is still being ruled by the same political party. South Africa is no different, Zimbabwe is no different, Namibia is no different. When that wave of change happens, we are at the same level of understanding of what we want to develop as a system that works. And then that answers the question whether there is a plan post. That's not a question for Eswatini. It's a question for the entire region. It's a question for the entire African region. We had the very same people that went to war, fought, won, and now they're in power. We still have the same problems, which comes the idea of fear for change. It's not an Eswatini thing. It's also a problem in Zimbabwe. I believe there are people who vote ZANU-PF out of fear for change. If we bought, yeah, if we bring the new party, what happens next? There is that fear. And I don't think Eswatini is excluded from that. So I think we really need to, yes, institutions are important, but we need a homogeneous, a generic approach that suits the culture of Africa. I read this story, I don't know if it's true, that post the building of, just 30 seconds, post the building of the Great Wall of China, it was invaded 3 times. No one could build over the wall, but the Mongolis had to bribe the guards so that they could get in. They built a wall to protect their people, but they failed to build the character of the individuals. What Mswati does is basically divergent to Ubuntu, Wunu. What we are taught as an African people, the way he's extravagant does not speak to an African person. Mm. And that philosophy has to be core in developing, in our education system, our kids, it has to be very important. And the issue of students, young people that are still in prison, I think we'll talk about that after. It's a very important issue. I'm very saddened that there are still people who are in prison since 2021. We need to find ways that we raise voices. We need to find if we can identify individuals that we can make the face to ensure that their voices are heard. The world has to hear such kind of issues. And as African people also, we have an obligation. Mm. Thank you.
Okay. I've been concentrating, trying to remember my brother's question here. There were 3 of them. Do I think democracy is a one-size-fit-all? It's a general question, but I can tell you why I believe it's a fit in Swaziland. If you follow the behavior, if you follow Swaziland, you realize that there's a lot of reports of corruption. Corruption by the king, corruption by those around him. And I sincerely believe that corruption is a phenomenon which can only happen if it's preying on a majority of honest people. And that's what we have seen in Swaziland. If you see the lived experience of ordinary Swazis, they are law-abiding, rule-respecting people. If they can sustain themselves and essentially put themselves under a condition whereby they are living by the rules, even though the rules are not fair on them, but they do their work honestly. They participate in societal activities honestly. Then those people are perfectly capable of conducting themselves in a fairer system than what exists right now. The entire reason why the king can apportion so much money to himself and those around him is because others are saying, okay, I can live a little bit with what resources I have. I'm not going to behave like him. So, in short, for Swaziland, it could be a fit. With respect to your question about what, and I think it's a question which relates to more, does democracy yield material improvements in your living condition? If you look at, if we do the calculations, if you have just a responsible government, even under the conditions that exist right now, some of the successes which are not spoken about enough in Swaziland is that in Swaziland, the state had no plan to look after people in any capacity. The idea of paying for children to attend school, having a school without fees, was something which was normal. Most of us went to primary school, elementary school, with our parents having to foot the tuition fees. The progressives in society, even though they were banned, were able to win basic freedoms, even basic, they are privileges, but they are actually rights, for a child to be able to get an education. Right now, the status is that you can get school education without paying fees for your primary school. High school is still a paid affair. Those are material improvements, which are won even without democracy, but due to the principle of people uniting under a shared concern to educate their children. So I have no doubt that material improvements do happen when people who are able to be held accountable are put in positions of power. It's better to have a short-term situation which you can correct after 5 years than to have a perpetual monarch who you can't do anything about. Your second question has slipped past me a little bit. If you're asking me for a barometer about what the people feel, whether they trust King Mswati to be their leader, if he was, I don't want to be the only one who's attempting to answer questions, but I'll give it a stab. What we do in the institutions that are developed, the Swaziland National Union of Students is meant to deal with that particular, to capacitate young people as they enter into the formalized school environment before entering into the work environment. They must understand how their society essentially deals with people in their position. So the education component of what you're asking is the responsibility of institutions, people's institutions, that we are in the process of trying to maintain and to develop further. So I think I'll stop there with my attempts at answering your questions. They are difficult questions, but thank you for asking them. Thank you. Yeah.
You know, it's
just 1 minute, comrades.
Yeah.
I know it's a very interesting discussion.
If you have access to him at some point, yeah, do tell him that he must open up the space and see if he's going to be voted into power. But I think the work that we do, amongst other things, is we understand the current conditions in the country. Organizing and mobilizing is very difficult, but we do it underground and above ground using certain tactics and methods that have been used in other places that have proved to work. But amongst other things, as Comrade Mandla has said, we put so much emphasis on political and capacity building of our membership, but also of the ordinary Swazis from the grassroots level. Because, I mean, for the longest time, if you have lived in a dictatorship for close to 60 years, you get to even not understand the basic definition of your human right as a being. So those are some of the things that we are trying to to correct. Part of it is the education that we're trying to give. But also, again, it is not going to be like today, Mswati says, no, I relinquish power. Tomorrow is a democracy. Let us go to elections. There needs to be a process that is going to, amongst other things, open the political space. I think in South Africa, they had that between 1990 and 94. Open the political space for all players to say, let us have access to these people. Let us have access to media. Let us have access to all these spaces where we can be able to convince the people, why should you vote this person over this person? I think that one is a process that takes time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so very much, comrade. Thank you all for coming. And a round of applause again for our panelists for doing the brilliant work. Want to thank you for educating us and for telling us what is happening in Eswatini and the great work that we are doing as well. We appreciate it. And we are solidly behind you. We have you. We are going to stand with you until victory. Aluta continua.